So these are what ought to be not too long comments on Glenn Coulthard. Coulthard was a student of Taiye K. Alfred, is coming from a very similar background, went through the program that Taiye K. ran. He seems to me to be offering a perspective which is totally commensurate with Taiye K.'s, with a more slightly more academic sounding and maybe technical sort of approach. But I find Taiye K. more fun to read, but I feel like the basic argument made in this second chapter about the land can tell you a lot of things about the meaning of the relationship between people and the land in North American, especially Dene, Northwest territories, indigenous understandings. But it also makes a very coherent argument about what went wrong in the process of resistance to land takeover on the part of Dene people between the 1970s and, say, like the 1990s. So in order to get into this, I wanted to begin by defining and explaining two different terms. Well, the first one is a term from Marx. The term is primitive accumulation, or the concept is primitive accumulation. This is something that exists in Marx, was somewhat important for Marx, but becomes much more important for neo-Marxist thinkers, especially around people like Silvia Federici, Maria Mies, who we read. The idea of primitive accumulation on the basic Marxist model is that while Marxist analysis describes, analyzes, takes into pieces, describes the functioning and the interrelations of elements within a capitalist society, and in a lot of ways really takes its foundation from the moment of alienation implicit in wage labor, which according to both the earlier and the later Marx are the origin of profit. It's the relationship between someone who controls the means of production and someone who is in a position where they have no option but to sell their time to this other person in order to generate a thing of value, which is then legally and practically controlled by the person who employed them, the owner, and which will be sold on a market for a profit, which profit will go into the pocket of the owner. That's the root of alienation. That's the root of profit. That's the root of capital in Marxism. And in early Marxist work, that's like the 1844 manuscripts, which we looked at. That's the starting point. But it's also, in large measure, the foundation of the analysis in Das Kapital. And yet there are further-reaching and more historical considerations in Marx and in that later work of Capital. And this is where you can find the thinking about primitive accumulation. So primitive accumulation in Marx's thought refers to a specific historical period. Here's where Silvia Federici and others like her will eventually disagree. But for Marx, when he's thinking about primitive accumulation, he's thinking of two things that we've talked quite a lot about. One would be the transition from feudal Europe to capitalist Europe, which is the primary historical pivot with which Marx was concerned. And if you wanted to be really critical, you could say, well, Marx doesn't really know much beyond European history from 1400 to when he was writing, 1860. This is what he's thinking about. Now, in Europe, primitive accumulation consisted in two dimensions, and the word always has these two dimensions, which Coulthard mentions as well. The dimensions are primitive accumulation of land and resources, on the one hand, and primitive accumulation of labor as wage labor, on the other hand, which implies proletarianization. Now, what distinguishes Marx's and Federici's view here is that Marx thinks that this happens, you know, once. It may take a long time, but it's a single period, and it ushers in the period of capitalist function, full exploitation, the accumulation of capital, and so on. You get past it historically. The two moments that he thinks about and that Federici thinks about are in Europe, the moment of, or the period, the century or two, of enclosures the taking over and reprivatization of land by feudal lords who are becoming capitalist-oriented, and the consequent displacement of peasant populations, especially into urban centers where already at that point proto-manufacturing or proto-assembly line manufacturing, larger scale manufacturing, was already going on. So in that place, we have the takeover of land, the control, the increased control of resources, including the commons, water, woods, fields, space, and of course, growing potential, agricultural growing potential. Specifically, it was the need to expand wool production, which drove this moment of enclosures. And then there's the accumulation of these people who are displaced from their land into the cities. That is the accumulation, the primitive accumulation of labor. Now, of course, this also happens in European colonial expansion. The takeover of North America is a moment or a period, few centuries long period, of primitive accumulation, meaning that the land of North America was gradually taken away from the indigenous peoples who had been living with it previously. One of Coulthard's sort of nuanced points is that at least for contemporary indigenous people in Canada, which is what he's specifically thinking about, primitive accumulation was experienced primarily in terms of the takeover of land, and less so in terms of the takeover of labor, such that it was still possible for Dene people in the 1970s and even the 1980s, and in a much smaller degree even to the present, to continue a mode of production, a way of living which is still connected to the land. They were less proletarianized, less swept up into industrial labor, but their land was the primary object of attack. Now, the difference between Marx and Federici here, and I think Federici's right, is that primitive accumulation on Federici's view never stops. It's not just a preliminary period through which capitalist relations, exchange, capital accumulation become possible. Rather, it is an ongoing feature of capitalist systems. And Federici has in mind, for example, the neoliberal thrust for further takeover of land, further proletarianization and of people and incorporation of people into exploitative wage relations in Africa, for example, where she worked for at least a decade, even in the 1990s and early 2000s. This is still going on. So according to her view, primitive accumulation, which, you know, if you wanted to put it more harshly or more simply, is simply raw violence. It's conquest of people who are not in this system by the system, which incorporates them into the system. It's sheer violence, which seizes land and resources which were not available to this system, such that they are now available to this system. Now, the second term I want to talk about is recognition. Recognition, we've seen this term in, I'd say, two important ways. And recently we had a very good discussion sort of ending up with considerations about recognition. You can find recognition as a key central concept in Hegel, where Hegel's model of freedom and full human being and dignity rest upon recognition. I am dehumanized insofar as people do not see me, do not recognize me as the free and full being, the dignified being which I really am. My freedom requires a process where people see me and I see them, and we are mutually recognizing one another, discussing and deciding in some human way. And there seems to be an historical but also a kind of spiritual struggle that goes on between some people and some other people for recognition. This is the master-slave dialectic, which we talked about in the past, right? One thing that I had in mind constructing this course was the degree to which that kind of Hegelian thinking becomes very important for, like, Black liberation thought. I think the point that we got to in our last discussion was very good, where we suggested that the models of freedom that we're holding up or that seems to be best justified in this course are, on the one hand, practical, individual, and collective models of praxis, but on the other hand, models of mutual recognition. So on the one hand, freedom has to do with identifying your own goal, thinking through how to get it, making a choice in order to do it. That would be individual, rational, free action. Or on the group level, and thus the political level, talking together about the situation, identifying goals, figuring out means by which to achieve those goals, and making a collective decision. That's praxis. But the Hegelian and also the indigenous, which is the other thing I want to say about recognition, the Hegelian and also the indigenous view about where free beings aim in acting freely. You act freely in order to achieve a situation of greater freedom on this model. And this is, so Hegel and like the Tzotzil philosophy that we have recently looked at would both suggest that what we're attempting to establish is a situation of mutual recognition. So as I said, this exists also for indigenous people. And I think there's a lot of similarity here between indigenous thought and Hegelian thought, and that to be free, to be human, is not a negative concept. It's not just the absence of something. It is a positive concept. It is the presence of something, and that something is a social phenomenon in which we are mutually recognized, respected, treated as dignified, and to push into the indigenous territory where the relationships that we carry out are typified by reciprocity. There's balance in those relationships. We each give to those relationships what they are due. It seems to me that the fundamental difference between the indigenous and the Hegelian views are that on the indigenous view, it is not only humans with whom we are in relationship and should be in relationship and where we can engage in mutual recognition, respect, mutual development, and sustaining of dignity. It's also all other things in the world, especially living things, which on this view probably includes the mountains and the stones. Now, the specific treatment that Coulthard makes of recognition is more specific than this. He wants to talk about 1960s to early 1980s struggles on the part of Dene people to push back capitalist and state expansion into their territory. They had been nominally incorporated. Well, they had been legally incorporated, but their land had not been breached and approached. What's the word? No thrust had been made to take over the land like that which would be seen come the 1950s and the 1960s. So in these initial phases of resistance to further land takeover by capitalist enterprises backed by state forces, there's originally one politics of recognition. And this is the specific language that's used in the political forum and in the legal forum, the recognition of native peoples, the recognition of nationhood. In this first instance, includes recognition of self-determination at the political and the economic and the cultural levels. But something happens. So we move from like a good cultural recognition where culture is understood to include the economic and the political dimension to another weaker version of recognition of sovereignty or recognition of culture, which excludes the economic and the political. So this is the story that he wants to tell. And I think this story can be told pretty easy. So the transition that Coulthard is talking about, and this is meant as a criticism of the politics of the Dene of whom he is a part, what he wants to answer is the question, what went wrong between the late 1970s and the present? And what went wrong is that the politics of recognition got hollowed out, got busted, got broken and fractured by the colonial interest. And a whole lot of native people involved in this struggle were swept along either because they simply could not resist the force of the process pushing on them, or because in various ways they succumbed to the logic and the so-called reason of the capitalist and state perspective. So he wants to, I think, reassert the value of the 1970s understanding of recognition, of being recognized as a cultural and a self-determining entity. So we can talk about the situation, or what the term he uses, which he derives from Marx, the mode of production or the mode of life of indigenous people in the Northwest Territory, which is a tremendously large area that we're talking about, right? We're talking about British Columbia, but all the way over to close to Montreal, the territory from which Taiyake comes. This is a massive territory, not all the way north, not all the way west, but encompassing most of northern Canada. Even up until, now of course there were processes of integration and land takeover and white colonial settling and boarding schools and prior phases of colonial struggle and violence leading up to the 20th century. But even up through the first half of the 20th century, as Coulthard tells the story, a whole lot of Dene people, maybe the majority of Dene people, were able to live in ways which were largely still indigenous. They were able still to take part in activities on a daily basis. And we're not just talking about ritual and so-called cultural in the thin sense activities. We're talking about economic, everyday activities, hunting, fishing, gathering wood, being in the land, being with the land, engaging in relationships with the other forms of life that are the land, that are included in the land. This is a mode of life which is indigenous, right? This is not an exhaustive definition of what that would mean, but according to Coulthard, these are central things, and this is a practical reading, right? People could live that way. But by the 1950s and the 1960s, a new economic, capitalist-driven and state-enforced onslaught in this territory was underway. So there's a massive expansion of mining and of the things that go along with mining. I think if you really want to think in a material way about what colonization is, you should think about mines and roads and here parks and oil and gas wells and pipelines, right? Think about infrastructure and think about how any extractive industry in particular, any manufacturing industry as well, implies not only a certain location or a certain type of locations, but also a massive net of infrastructure which connects those locations and connects those locations to the larger already developed infrastructures of the colonizing north. So here we have mines, roads, parks, oil and gas networks. So it is in this context, and certainly with some influence, some inspiration from the Black Power movement, that the Red Power movement begins, the American Indian movement begins in the early 1970s. The women's movement really gets going. The gay movement gets going. All of these liberation movements seem to be instigated with civil rights and then fueled by the turn to Black Power. So with some influence from that, but also because of the changing conditions where they were, the Dene engage in a struggle to be recognized as self-determining, to be recognized under this colonial system as having a right to the land, a right to protect the land, a right to make decisions about the land, since those decisions also impact the way of life and the context of life for Dene people. And the key point here is that the language is about cultural recognition, but that does not mean what it would mean primarily for us today, because folded into the notion of cultural, of being recognized as a cultural entity that has certain rights and that is self-determining and that needs to be preserved and recognized in its difference, preserved, given dignity, implied in this notion of culture was also the economic and the political dimension. to be recognized as a cultural autonomous identity, which is what activists of this time were demanding, meant also to be recognized as a sovereign nation that has the right and the maintained capacity to make use of so-called resources, to maintain land, which is really family, and a kind of spatial manifestation of the people themselves, which extends to animals and other living things, a recognition of their right to sustain and make determinations about that land, to make determinations about the economic level, the level of like what the colonizers would call resources, and also a political right to self-determination. So in the mid-1970s, to demand cultural recognition also meant to demand recognition of self-determination politically and economically. But things change. This is the critique. So Coulthard goes through some detailed renderings of the legal process, which you can check out on your own. But there are also key events that take place in the 1980s that lead to the deterioration and the weakening of this model of cultural recognition, such that the cultural recognition demanded and received in the 1990s and 2000s is a thinner version which excludes self-determination at the economic and political levels. The primary thing is the development of resources, of extractive industries in the region, and the selling out of a whole bunch of people in indigenous communities for the monetary gain to be had by being integrated in these extractive efforts, specifically the discovery of a massive amount of oil, the Prudhoe oil, and the development of the Mackenzie Valley pipeline. So this is the later 1980s and the 1990s. Now, along with this proposed pipeline, which is still being fought and still being advanced, we have all the infrastructure that goes along with it: roads, airstrips, camps, gravel pits to build those roads and other concrete things, storage sites, stream and river crossings, gas plants. And then by the 2000s, there's further intensification of economic extractive activity, diamond mining on the part of indigenous groups themselves, such that by the present, or I guess he's writing about 5 years ago, the cultural recognition that is received, that is granted to indigenous peoples, to the Dene people, is now weaker than it used to be, such that to be recognized culturally as an indigenous nation implies certain rights to have maybe a few sacred places retained or to have access to them, to have a special relationship maybe to education. But it does no longer mean having control over the land. That control over the land had to be exchanged for these slimmer recognitions and protections at a cultural level. And the cultural level in this impoverished Western sense, where cultural means specifically not political or economic. So political self-determination is given, but only a limited degree. It's given in forms that are dictated from without, in councils, band councils or Aboriginal councils, which are integrated into the larger Canadian governmental machinery and weighed against the other elements of that machinery. So political self-determination on a robust scale is lost. Economic determination and real control or ownership of the land is passed off. And so there's a recognition of indigeneity, but there's actually an erosion of the foundation and the reality on an everyday level of indigeneity. So let me just, complete these thoughts by pointing out that there's a strong similarity here between Coulthard's analysis and what we've seen in Agamben and Tikkun. Remember, Agamben's analysis in his essay on the form of life is that the contemporary form, maybe all forms of sovereignty, the power of the state consists in reducing the body to bare life. External forces perpetually threaten that body, and the manipulations, for example, of infrastructures and the flow of water and air and food can sustain that body or not. It is this dimension of infrastructure and bare life which is handed over from indigenous control, Dene control, at the beginning of the 20th century, even in the 1960s, to Canadian governmental control and capitalist control by the 2000s, right? And then there's an identity which is built on top of this fundamental insecurity, this being under a sovereign, which now becomes the case in a much fuller way for Dene people. There is an identity given to them which is indigenous, quote unquote, and it goes along with certain forms of strictly cultural, not political or economic activity. And this is what Agamben and Tikkun suggested to us, that a lot of contemporary ideas are like. We break apart the body, its passions, real determination at a bodily level, even the capacity for political self-determination, because modern sovereignty tends to break people apart into atomized units. And then we are re-given some kind of identity which has a meaning, which has a symbolic place in the overall symbolic order of the colonial system. This is what happened to the Dene people. And I think what Coulthard would like to see, what Taiyake would like to see, and what Tikkun would like to see are all sort of the same thing. In Tikkun, it would be the return of an integral or cohesive form of life. And almost in the same language in this indigenous thought, the return of a fully robust and autonomous and land-based way of life or mode of life, where the land is not reduced to resources but remains an aspect of the being of the people and a responsibility of the people, where decisions that affect the people and the land are carried out on the land by the people, political self-government, self-determination, and the rituals and practices and so-called religious and artistic forms are allowed to continue. The problem is that, well, some people want to struggle in that way, but not enough people, I suppose. And what we're left with is a situation where, although indigenous people are profiting in a capitalist sense from the land, their relationship to the land, which made them who they were at a deep level, but not just at a spiritual level, also at a very practical and material level, that relationship to the land of reciprocity, of removing so-called resources only insofar as they are sustainable, and really not thinking about the land as resources at all, that mode of life is gone. And so even as certain people who can be called indigenous at a cultural level continue to exist and even are monetarily empowered by the exploitation of the land, they increasingly are colonized and are colonial in their behavior. And one of those key behaviors is seeing the land as nothing but a set of resources. So they are being alienated from the land, and the removal of this practical activity in terms of land and place continues a process of genocide,